This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's a pleasure for me to introduce our next speaker, Danielle Brandman. It was a very impressive, bright young star that we were very fortunate to recruit 2 years ago. Now working like a seasoned veteran already within a short time. So Danielle's interest is in fatty liver disease, and her talk today is in nutrition and liver disease. My recollection is that we've never given a talk before in this program. So Danielle.
Thank you, Francis, and I'm really pleased to be a part of this conference. I think this is my third year. I feel really fortunate to have benefited from the mentorship of Tony as well, and I can only hope to be half as eloquent and clever as he is at some point in my life. So with that, I think nutrition's a really important topic. And I'm hoping that this talk will be useful for you guys. I feel like I actually learned quite a bit putting it together. So the things that I will be covering will be mainly malnutrition and cirrhosis, assessment of functional capacity in patients with cirrhosis, and really how it pertains to their waitlist mortality and post-transplant outcomes. Because of time limitations, I will not be covering diet and fatty liver disease as well as post-transplant obesity, but I believe my slides are in the handout, and so you can consider those supplemental slides, and if you have questions, we can maybe discuss those later. So this is really just a generic patient that I'm sure many of us have come across many times. A 60-year-old man with hepatitis C cirrhosis with refractory ascites. He's listed for transplant, has a MELD score only of 18, and he's lost 50 pounds over the past 6 months, has visible muscle wasting, and now has a BMI of 19. You're obviously concerned that he's malnourished. So I think the question of malnutrition in this patient is really not even a question. It's quite obvious. But I think malnutrition in a lot of our patients might be a little bit more subtle. The true prevalence of malnutrition in cirrhosis is really not clear. The studies that are out there have used multiple methods of evaluating nutritional status, which is why we have a range of anywhere from 20 to 100%. And there's no standard definition of malnutrition really as it pertains to patients with cirrhosis. It can be difficult to assess because of impaired hepatic function leading to low albumin, as well as fluid retention falsely inflating the BMI. We know the pathogenesis is certainly multifactorial. Patients are not eating well. They have metabolic disturbances mainly in the form of increased catabolism, and they may be malabsorbing their fats and their fat-soluble vitamins if they're cholestatic. They also have decreased storage capacity in the liver, which again might lead to decreased glycogen stores as well as vitamin deficiencies. So how do we assess their nutritional status? Again, if it's not as obvious as that wasted patient that I showed you. The biochemical parameters such as albumin are definitely fraught with problems because if a patient has impaired liver function, they can have a low albumin. If they're getting IV albumin with their paracentesis, it might be falsely elevated. Subjective global assessment includes an assessment of weight change, dietary intake, GI symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, their functional capacity, and physical signs of malnutrition, although some would suggest that this method may even underestimate malnutrition in the cirrhotic patients. Used together with hand grip strength, it might actually be beneficial and a good predictor of nutritional status. When using things that are reliant upon the patient, like 24-hour recall and food frequency questionnaire, that can also be problematic because relying upon the patient to actually tell us what they're eating, and if they're encephalopathic, they may not remember. While they're in the hospital, calorie count, of course, will be very accurate, but again, really only useful while the patient is in the hospital. Can't really do that while they're at home. You can try to have patients take a food diary, and they can do essentially their own calorie count. So, of course, there are consequences of malnutrition, and I think this data probably overestimates the effect of malnutrition, but I think it's really unclear since the patients who are malnourished also tend to have more severe liver disease. But in some reports, hepatic encephalopathy, refractory ascites, SBP, and hepatorenal syndrome were much more common than in patients who were well-nourished. But again, teasing out the effects of the liver disease itself and the nutritional status is really difficult to do, and I think really kind of feed into each other. So what do we tell our patients when they come in to see us, even if they're not that patient who is completely wasted? So the caloric intake that we should be telling them to have is about 25 to 35 calories per kilo per day. And in a patient who is known to be malnourished, they should be having more, 30 to 40. Their protein intake should be anywhere from 1 to 1.5 grams of protein per kilo per day, up to a maximum of 100 grams per day, and recommending most of the protein sources be from vegetables rather than meat proteins, really worrying about the meat proteins leading to worse hepatic encephalopathy. But I will go into a little bit more detail about nutrition and encephalopathy in a couple of slides. There is some interest in branched-chain amino acids as well. I will expand upon that as well. I think we're always tempted to tell these patients who have lost weight to just eat whatever you can, but I don't think that's always the best advice, and they really should limit their carbohydrate intake to less than 5 to 6 grams per kilo per day and limit their fat intake to 25 to 30% of their calories. Small, frequent meals should be encouraged as well. I think a lot of these patients don't have a great appetite, so even when they do eat, they're probably not taking full meals anyway. I think we just have to remind them to keep eating throughout the day, and I'll, again, expand upon this in a couple of slides. So thinking about protein intake and hepatic encephalopathy, I think it's kind of really the older view that these patients should restrict how much protein they're taking in because we worry about making their encephalopathy worse. One group actually looked at patients who were admitted with hepatic encephalopathy, and they compared patients who they restricted protein to 0.5 gram per kilo per day to those with a normal protein diet, which was defined as 1 gram per kilo per day. And it looked like, in general, the rate of improvement in encephalopathy throughout the course of admission was about the same. There were no statistically significant differences. We also worry that the low protein intake may actually lead to muscle breakdown and could eventually lead to worsened hepatic encephalopathy. Glutamine is converted to ammonia, so theoretically could worsen hepatic encephalopathy, but I think the clinical significance of this is really not known. But again, if you're making recommendations, it would be reasonable to try to avoid glutamine. There's more and more interest in the role of pre and probiotics, I think, in a lot of areas of GI, and it may improve hepatic encephalopathy as well. So again, might be something good to include in your nutritional recommendations for your patients. So I think a lot of people have been told that if you eat before you go to bed, it's really not a good thing. I think we tell a lot of our patients with reflux that they should not be eating right before they go to bed. Turns out that's the wrong thing to be telling our patients with cirrhosis, and there's actually a fair amount of data that if they have a late evening snack, they actually will derive some benefit. The rationale is that these patients are in such a highly catabolic state that they're just burning through their glycogen stores. What takes a person with a normal liver to burn through their stores would be about 3 days versus 10 hours in a patient with cirrhosis. So you really want to limit the time that they're fasting. Types of snacks that have been studied include Ensure Plus, Diabetic Resource, as well as supplements containing branched-chain amino acids. And the effects of nocturnal supplementation have been increased total body protein, decreased rates of liver-related morbidity and mortality, and decreased frequency of paracentesis. When they compare this to patients supplemented with the same types of supplements during the day, there was really more benefit in the patients who are supplemented at night. And I think it really goes back to limiting that period of catabolism in these patients. It's something we should consider when patients are in the hospital and they're undergoing a lot of procedures, and I think it's not an uncommon occurrence on our service when the patient is fasting all day, and I think we kind of take for granted the effect that that may take on them. So what about branched-chain amino acids? There had been a lot of interest in branched-chain amino acids in terms of treatment of hepatic encephalopathy, and some of that data is mixed. There's more recent data showing that it may reduce the incidence and recurrence of HCC, may improve insulin resistance, and may lead to improvements in albumin synthesis, as these three amino acids are really the building blocks of protein and muscle. But again, the data is not strong, but there really doesn't seem to be any harm in using these things. So again, might be a good thing to add to our recommendations. The optimal dose of these is really unknown. And if you look at different protein powders that are out there sold at GNC, they're really widely ranging doses. And the doses used in various studies are definitely not uniform, and there's no uniform ratio of one to another. So I think we still need to learn a little bit more about these. The other problem is that they tend to be poorly palatable, and this may lead to decreased compliance of the patients taking these things. So there was one study that randomized patients to supplements containing branched-chain amino acids versus dextran versus albumin, and the patients with branched-chain amino acids really tended to do the best. There was only a trend towards better outcomes in terms of death, hospital stay, and length of stay. Difference was not statistically significant, but the patients did do much, much better than the patients who received albumin. These graphs, the patients with the black bars are patients who'd received branched-chain amino acids. There was no significant impact on albumin compared to the other two groups, but bilirubin appeared to decrease more in the branched-chain amino acid groups, as did Child Pugh score. Now, tube feedings. I think a lot of us think of this as kind of the last resort, and we're pushing tube feedings for patients who look very wasted. I think once they get to that point, it might actually be too late. And when you look at the papers that have looked at enteral feeding, there really was no survival benefit, and it's probably because those patients had more advanced liver disease, so they end up dying because of their advanced liver disease, so you really don't see the benefit of enteral feeding. But I think if we start it sooner, they may benefit more. The types of tube feedings in general should be concentrated, high-energy formulas containing at least 1.5 kilocalories per milliliter. And this is because a lot of the patients have issues with fluid retention as well as hyponatremia, so we really don't want to add fuel to that fire. And this is really just a list of some of the types of formulas that are available. So, to summarize some of the key points about nutrition, we see that protein restriction may not be helpful in terms of improving hepatic encephalopathy, and I think there's really good data to show that it may, again, add fuel to the catabolic storm that these patients are in. So really should not be recommending protein restriction. There can be an improvement in liver-related morbidity and mortality with the use of a late-evening snack and possibly with branched-chain amino acids. I think we should really consider early nutrition referral as well as consideration of enteral feeding to try to increase these patients' nutritional status. So moving on to what are the consequences of malnutrition, and in general, sarcopenia, impaired functional status, and decreased muscle strength are what we commonly see in these malnourished patients. There are several ways to assess body composition, such as anthropometric measures, such as skin fold thickness, mid-arm muscle circumference, BMI, and waist and hip circumferences. But some of these measures are operator-dependent, and then fluid retention and ascites can really interfere with accurate BMI and waist and hip circumferences, and really doesn't tell you much about their true body composition. Bioelectrical impedance can be interesting also to look at body composition, but can be affected by the patient's fluid status. Newer models of the machines that take these measurements do have programs to take into account the patient's fluid status. DEXA has long been considered the gold standard for body composition and is readily available, non-invasive, and our patients should be getting DEXAs anyway. So again, we really should take a look at this. L3 skeletal muscle index is also something that's been used more recently, as well as other muscles being measured, such as psoas and the transverse abdominal muscle. Again, most of our patients are getting CT scans, so it's really easy to look at this information. However, we don't have any standard cutoffs to say, at this level of, or this area of muscle mass, then we're really concerned about them. So I think, again, this is an area that needs a little bit more exploration. So what is sarcopenia? It's defined as low muscle mass and either low muscle strength or low physical performance. In our obese patients, this can still happen. And this is because they can have poor muscle quality, perhaps due to fat infiltration of the muscles, just like you might see in a ribeye steak. So their muscles are just not as functional as other people's muscles. And this whole process may be influenced by insulin resistance. It can be seen in all stages of liver disease, but interestingly tends to be more common in our male patients. Unclear why this is, but I hypothesize it could be due to some of the hormonal effects, since the estrogens and other feminizing hormones may be in higher concentration in these patients than they normally are in men, so they might have a greater effect. It can also be seen in all BMIs. Not surprisingly, the patients with very low BMI were universally affected by sarcopenia, but it was seen in a proportion of patients who were overweight or obese, affecting 43% of the men. So again, just because your patient is a healthy weight or overweight, they still might have decreased muscle mass. Patients who are sarcopenic tend to do poorly on the waiting list. And when we break this down by MELD score, the patients who do really poorly are those who have a MELD score less than 15 and who are sarcopenic. And this is probably because these patients are sitting on the waiting list, and unless they have a live donor, they're not going anywhere. They're not getting transplanted, and they're just continuing to waste away. So I think if you find a patient that is sarcopenic, this is really the area where we could intervene or really push for living donor transplant before they start to fall off the curve. It seems to have an effect on post-transplant survival as well. And when the group at University of Michigan used different quartiles of psoas area as measured by CT scan pre-transplant, the patients who fell into the smallest quartile of psoas area did really poorly, with their one-year survival being only 50%, which is pretty abysmal. At 3 years, only about 30% of those patients were alive. Again, there's no real cutoff for what is a risky psoas area, but I think if we see kind of a thread-like psoas on someone's CT scan, it's something we really have to worry about, and I think this is something that we really need to look into a bit more as well as a predictive factor for post-transplant outcomes. So another group recently published in Liver Transplantation, and they modeled sarcopenia as it occurred in both men and women, and the effects were different in men and women. For each 10% increase in muscle mass in men, they had a reduction in their length of hospital stay post-transplant, they were intubated for fewer days, and they had a lower risk of in-hospital post-transplant death. There was a modest effect in the women, and there's really no association with post-transplant death. It could be that the female group was actually smaller than the men, so it could have just been underpowered to detect a difference. But going back a few slides, just thinking that the women seemed to be less affected by sarcopenia, that could be what's going on here as well. So what happens with body composition post-transplant? Several groups have looked at this, and in some of the earlier studies, it looks like muscle mass remains reduced in these patients and really does not increase. In two studies that were done at UCSF, in the patients who underwent exercise training, there was a significant increase in muscle mass. Should notice that in just about all of the studies, fat mass is increasing. So I think we've all seen patients post-transplant gain weight year after year, and I do wonder if this imbalance between increased fat and lower muscle mass is really accounting for the high rates of post-transplant metabolic syndrome. So moving on to functional status, which again, their functional status can be impaired as a result of their lower muscle mass. We can assess it using 6-minute walk test, which has been looked at a bit more recently in the liver transplant population, but has been used for a long time in the lung transplant population. We can also use aerobic or exercise capacity using measurement of oxygen utilization, grip strength, and then the Fried Frailty instrument has been used a lot in the geriatric population, and one of our other hepatologists, Jennifer Lai, who's currently in San Francisco on call, she's really interested in this measure, and I will show some of her data a bit later. So using the 6-minute walk test, 250 meters is really considered to be the bare minimum of the distance that someone should be able to walk. So if you are unable to walk 250 meters in 6 minutes, you are very likely to die on the waiting list within 1 year. We've been using this test in our patients who are over 70, which is where this test might be best validated, and we're kind of using it as a screening tool right now to say who might do poorly after transplant. This hasn't been as well validated in the patients who are under 70, but again, I think is really worth looking at. So this is data from Jennifer Lai. She's included about 260 patients who are listed for transplant at UCSF, and about 20% of the patients were found to be frail using the Fried Frailty Assessment. And in the patients who had lower MELD scores, 26% of these patients died or were removed from the waiting list. The patients with MELD score greater than 18, their frailty status really didn't seem to make a difference. And this really seems to mirror the data on sarcopenia and low MELD, again, thinking that these patients with low MELD score are sitting on the waiting list and going nowhere. So this is the group that we really do need to intervene upon. So just to talk briefly about aerobic capacity of liver transplant candidates, to do an accurate assessment, you can use this metabolic cart and calculate the VO2 max. It's something that's not done commonly in clinical practice just because it can be very time and labor intensive as well as very costly. But when done, it actually does provide very useful information. I think it's important to find surrogates that kind of represent the data that we get from this testing. So in patients with cirrhosis, when people have measured exercise capacity using this method, exercise capacity was found to be reduced, and the impairment seems to be associated with the severity of liver disease. These patients also tend to have impairments in physical strength. And when people have used training programs, it may increase muscle mass, but it may not necessarily increase exercise capacity. And looking at this graph, you see that 85% of these liver transplant candidates were considered to have some degree of impairment in their aerobic capacity, with 60% having severe impairment. The factors that may contribute to this include ascites, anemia, a lot of them have been smokers, older age may be linked to reduced fitness, gender may play a role, fatigue, very big common in our patients, and beta blockers may play a role as well, since a lot of these patients may not be able to mount an adequate tachycardic response to exercise. And how does this equate to post-transplant survival? So the patients who had poor fitness as measured by a VO2 max of less than 60%, within the 1 year post-transplant, only 65% of the patients were alive. And when you separate the groups out with the patients who had higher MELD scores greater than 17, the patients appeared to do even worse. So again, really important predictive information. I think we really do need to find surrogates for this measure of fitness. Post-transplant, most studies do show that there are improvements in the functional capacity post-transplant, and there may or may not be an improvement in their physical strength. And just thinking about what happens with body composition, it could be because they're not really gaining the muscle back, but they're just gaining fat. So to summarize, we see that sarcopenia is independent of BMI and can be present in all stages of liver disease, but is more common in advanced disease. this may not completely resolve post-transplant. And I think we really do need to focus our efforts on our cirrhotic patients and the ones who we deem to be at risk before they really fall off the curve. So exercise programs and nutritional supplementation. I think the patients who are obese, diabetic, they really present a challenge, and I think there are no specific recommendations about what their diet should look like. Again, a lot of them have to lose weight, but we want them to gain muscle while losing weight at the same time. So a real challenge. We do see increased weightless mortality with sarcopenia or poor functional status, and aerobic capacity is reduced in cirrhosis and may improve post-transplant. So, thank you.
Great job on this. Questions? Oh, Marion?
So the question was, has anyone looked at the role of nighttime enteral feedings who are not necessarily cachectic or malnourished? I think most of the supplements that have been studied have been oral supplements, but I think that would be something that would be interesting to really look at. And again, you know, I think so many of our patients are malnourished that you could argue that most of our patients might benefit from some sort of enteral feeding once they reach a certain threshold. Right. So I think the point was about how creatinine is also affected by muscle mass, and those patients are really further disadvantaged by the use of MELD, since their MELD score may not accurately represent the true severity of their liver disease and may account for why we're seeing them fall off the wait list at a much greater rate than the patients with higher MELD scores. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Pauly. So we're using the 6-minute walk test at this point at our program, just in patients who are older than 70 years old and mainly in patients who've been listed for transplant for at least 2 years. I think if the patient is listed at the age of 70, we kind of trust our eyeball assessment that if the patient really appears to be robust, then we think they'll be okay. But if they're waiting on the list for at least 2 years and they're 70 years old, I think we do have to take a closer look at their functional status. And we've been using a cutoff of 250 meters as the point where we say we're really worried about this patient and we may be likely to delist them. If they're close to that threshold, then it warrants a discussion in our selection conference. So it's kind of a case-by-case basis in a way. Right. For patients older than 70, we are using the 6-minute walk test. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.